Rusty Quill presents Below Decks, a Thrice Forgotten Deep Dive. Episode 8, Making the Music.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Below Decks, where we dig into some of the research, questions, stories, and generally tangential interesting things that went into making Thrice Forgotten. I'm Raffaella, my pronouns are she, they, and I'm the director of the series, as well as one of the writers. So today, very excitingly, we are going to talk about the music. Last time, Nemo talked a little bit about the process of the sound design. And this week, we're going to talk more about what went into creating the music itself. This is coming out towards the end of the series, either after episodes 8 or 9, we're not entirely sure, but we'll steer clear of spoilers, just in case. We are thrilled to be joined today by our guest, Sam Jones, who I'm going to ask him to introduce himself. Sam, please tell us, what have you done to contribute to Thrice Forgotten?
Hi, yeah, I'm Sam Jones, he, him, and I am resident composer at Rusty Quill and composer of the score for Thrice Forgotten. Very happy to be here. Hello.
Yeah, our score. Sorry.
Score's the word, yeah.
It's one of the reasons I'm very excited to be doing this episode, because the music is an element of the show that we know that listeners have consistently loved. And of course, we are also joined by Nemo, who definitely doesn't need an introduction at this point, but Nemo, give us one anyway.
Hello, I'm Nemo Martin. My pronouns are they, them, and I am the creator of this show. Yes, I can confirm I get many, many DMs about the music, and I'm like, hell yeah, and I know your website off by heart now, Sam. And I'm like, here's the SoundCloud, and here's it on Spotify. You can stream it. Go, go, go.
Yeah, I think how can we have the music has been one of the most asked questions about the series. So I'm going to kick off by asking Sam, you, as you said, you're the resident composer for Rusty Quill. What does that mean? Tell us more about that and what you do.
Crikey. I mean, what it means is I've been friends with Alex for about 29 years. And he asked me when he started the company to write him some music, some theme tunes for some podcasts he was doing. And that hasn't stopped. And so that's what that means. It means that he stuck with me. And I mean, we just kind of ended up with parallel careers, and we always said, let's work together. And he's always been very loyal to me as a composer. So he consistently asks me to write music to various podcasts that Rusty Quill are doing, which is all very exciting, very interesting work.
And so because you've done so many, is there sort of a blanket approach kind of to finding your way into creating the music for a show, or what does it depend on? What makes it different?
Well, what makes it different is the content is so varied. Every podcast is so different. But yeah, in terms of approach, that's something that I guess Alex and I kind of got to grips with early on. I mean, there is no one way to do it, but it's all kind of changed over the years, really, depending on very practical things like money and, you know, what the growing team in each podcast has wanted. So, for instance, when I spoke to you about this early on, I kind of already had a method of doing things, which is like, this is what you're going to need when it comes to editing it all, and that's sort of the amount of music you're going to want and stuff like that. But essentially, my questions are always the same at the beginning of the process, and I just want an idea of energy and tone. They're the two questions that I ask, avoiding any sort of semblance of like musical parlance. I don't want to hear what the director or producer wants specifically musically at first. I don't want to know, because 90% of the time, no matter how good they are musically, it isn't exactly what they want. And Alex will attest to that as well. He would always say, you know, I really want more trumpet here, and I'm like, no, you don't. You don't want trumpet. Not that I have anything against trumpets. In fact, the first notes I wrote for him were trumpet in the gaming podcast. Anyway, yeah, I try and keep it really a non-music specific conversation at first, to make it very about tone and about the energy of stuff. And specifically for this, it was about who or what or where needs music, and, you know, what needs to be represented musically, because, you know, it's quite long form, right? I've been podcasts in a series, it's a long narrative structure, so it's quite hard to, without actually sitting down and scoring it minute by minute, which we knew we couldn't do for this, to know what you're going to need for however many episodes is quite tough to predict. So those were kind of our initial conversations, I think.
The music was one of the first kind of elements of directing the show that I interacted with. So having written my episodes of it, and having worked with Nemo on sort of a bit of the kind of script editing of the series, and to Nemo can attest, we spent long hours kind of going, does this make sense? Okay, if we put this clue here and this reveal here. So by the time I could talk to you, Sam, I had the shape of the show very definitely in my head. But it absolutely was a process, like I said, of going, where do we need music? And it being, it's almost a bit of a guessing game. Like, you can kind of never know absolutely. As a director, I'm kind of going, okay, with my sort of director and my dramaturgy brain on, I guess, my script editor brain in gear, I'm going, okay, well, I think that we're going to want to save X, Y, and Z things for the end. It's really tempting to kind of spend all of our resources at the beginning of the series, but actually this is who we need to prioritize, or these are the characters that we need to prioritize, and which is sort of brilliant and exhilarating but also terrifying, because I said you are mostly just kind of guessing about what you're going to need. And fortunately for us, the music has worked out incredibly well on this show.
Very glad.
Going back to picking up what you said about not initially wanting any kind of, I was going to say musical notes, which is a terrible unintended pun, but you know what I mean, like specifically musical terminology, and just wanting vibes. That was something that I found incredibly helpful, because I'm not a musical person at all. Should we talk about, because also Nemo, I was drawing very much on our conversations for then these conversations I had with Sam. What were the early vibes that we wanted to put in place for this series?
Yeah, it was interesting hearing Sam talk about like scoring the entire show, because I was like, oh yeah, of course, somebody would have had to think about that, because I completely had only realized just now that that wouldn't be possible having this conversation, but knew that there were like three or four bits of music in the show, especially Anne's flute was pretty early on. Because she's really sneaky, she sneaks up on people, and it's really hard to do that without a visual component to how to tell that she is coming, how to foreshadow her, basically. And I was like, oh, the flute would be a really interesting way to do that. Obviously, Alestes's childhood backstory being the, like, key one.
Yeah, we did have these sort of key pieces of music that are in universe, that are inside the script, and absolutely, Anne's flute is one of them, which it's... Yeah, it's such a clever way of kind of having a sort of quite sinister character, I think, sort of arrive in the background of a scene on audio. The lullaby, I would say Nanny singing,
yeah,
which we have had in episode 2, so that's all right for me to talk about.
Yeah.
Oh, can you think of any other sort of like in-universe pieces of music?
The one that I found the most funny, Siva singing the Alexander song.
Singing the British Grenadier.
Yes, that's it, yeah.
Yes, that was a joke that I could not quite resist. But I think the flute and the lullaby then went into defining the tone of the music and the tone of the show as a whole, because they're both quite haunting pieces of music. And I think that is something that became very apparent, that for all that this is a nautical epic and a sort of rollicking pirate adventure, ultimately, the characters are informed by these things that they can't let go of or are trying to let go of, especially Alestes, obviously, being constantly sort of followed around by her own past. Mm. Yeah, Sam, does that kind of seem, thinking about those early conversations that we had about how this should sound, both in terms of its genre, but also how it's different from what we normally think of this genre as being.
Absolutely, and I remember specifically the lullaby being very early in our conversations, and actually I remember it being a puzzle for me to solve at one point, because I, being overeager as I am, had already started the main title, and then was talking, just going forwards, what to do, and then there was the mention of the lullaby, and me needing to realise its importance narratively, and then finding a way to weave that in. And Lullaby is one of those happy things that literally happened as soon as I, which doesn't happen. But I literally just sat down and played it and, you know, had the words in front of me and the tune came to mind, and that was nice because when that happens to me, I don't know, usually you get nervous about when that happens, you're like, no, this needs to be changed, but actually it felt right. And you know, just with very straightforward musical influence, really, it's just this idea of a pentatonic scale, five-note scale, which is seen all across folk music across the world. And so it just seemed right. And I managed to find a way to get that into the main title, quite subtly in the end, but because it's quite bombastic. But yeah, absolutely. Those were conversations very early on, and specifically because the main title was the first venture, I guess it was important to get that sense of adventure but also really put you in place straight away, and to get that tone bang on took a couple of goes, I think. But yeah, that was a really fun thing to integrate those, like specifically the flute as well. That's something I remember us talking about quite a lot, and really wanting that to be as accurate as possible and just really feel right. And that immediately, as soon as we had those discussions, was like, right, we need to get it recorded by a really good player, and you know, all of this. And those were very early decisions in this process for me as well.
Tell us about that instrument, because one of my memories from the process is hearing an early draft of the theme, which was already sounding brilliant, but then I remember you sort of saying, oh, this thing, I've put in a temporary instrument, but we're actually going to record with a different instrument. And when I then heard that, I was like, oh my God, you know, it sort of lifted it into a whole other dimension.
Yeah, well this project, more than any I've done, is one where the recorded elements have changed it, completely just made it. And I've been very, very fortunate with the players I've had record for this. Flutes firstly. I mean, we talked very early on, specifically you wanted a sao truc, which is this Vietnamese bamboo flute, which proved very, very difficult to get hold of. And I tried, you know, the best sort of avenue I had to try and get someone was actually my erhu player, who I'd already had in place. I was like, immediately, as soon as I knew what I needed for LSDs, I knew I needed an erhu. So I happened to know someone, and I was like, do you happen to know any Vietnamese sao truc players? It just proved very, very difficult. But up my sleeve, I did have a reserve option, and to call him a reserve option is a bit mean, because he's this veteran of Hollywood film recording.
Oh my God.
A guy called Tony Hinnigan, who has played on Avatar, on Braveheart, on Titanic. There's actually a funny story, which is, so he came over to my studio to record, and he brought about five like travel cases full of flutes.
Oh my God.
And he said that's less than half his collection. Wow. I knew him by reputation and was very lucky to get him in. And because of the nature of those flutes, the mechanics of them and them being built in certain scales and not being what we call chromatic, so they can't change between keys. You have a different flute for every key, and he had to bring lots to be able to build up these melodies and get the right sound as well. And in the end, I think we tried out a few different ones, actually. We tried out some Chinese flutes called dizzies, and we tried out various bamboo flutes that are identical to the sao truc. And we eventually arrived at the right sound, the right pitch. And what he gave was just a great performance. I mean, you can hear it. It just really changes it. Like, it's something you cannot demo. Like, I sent it to you, and I think the first thing I said was, this will sound different. It will sound better.
Yeah.
And I think that's been proven. This, the player just changes it. And while I'm there as well, I'll talk about the erhu as well. Again, very fortunate to get one, who a friend of mine from college, who is a successful erhu session player and live player. And wow, I mean, all I had was like a cello sample, and I told you, like, immediately, this is going to sound very, very different.
Yes, I remember this, yeah.
And he was one of those sort of dream recording artists, basically. They just send you back three versions, the version that you ask for, the version you say you can play around with, and then their version, and you always use their version because it's the best one. And it was so nice to work with him. It all had to be remote, of course, because he's over, I think, in Hong Kong. Yeah, he was amazing as well. And these are the things that I think brought it to life and really put you in place. That's the thing that helps set that tone, set the scene as well. So very, very fortunate. Yeah. To get those two in particular. There were other people who recorded as well, more mostly Western instruments, but they again lifted it to just be a different thing, really.
I remember this is a question we kind of went over a lot early on, was being very concerned about getting our sense of place, of kind of our, this show is set kind of in and around the Indian Ocean, these are our characters are. And I think I just remember sort of repeatedly going, it's not Pirates of the Caribbean, we can't do Pirates of the Caribbean, because first of all we're not in the Caribbean, but also secondly it's not through that kind of Western gaze, it's not centering a group of white people. So yeah, that was the first question, was how do we touch on what is kind of stirring and familiar about the idea of the nautical epic and the thing that makes you go, oh yeah, we're off on an adventure, and at the same time go, but this is, you're being invited to look at this genre in a different way, which very much came from Nemo. The conversations we'd had about your sort of love-hate relationship with the genre of nautical epics. So I think we were trying to reflect that in the music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my favourite thing to do as well, is kind of negotiate those challenges. I like to write something that's fusion-y, but getting that precise balance was the challenge here, I think. Like, it had to have an element of that nautical epic, right? And I think early on as well, you wanted a bit of a contemporary edge as well that was had a bit more beat to it. But then, you know, finding a way that the massive orchestral stuff you often hear, you know, the Hans Zimmery, Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, is just one element of the things you're hearing. And that was a really, really nice challenge with this.
So that's the theme. Let's talk about some of the other music in the show, because sort of you alluded to this at the beginning, Sam, with sort of saying we have to kind of try and predict what music we're going to need. So let's talk about that, because we have different beds for different characters. And obviously, I think I feel like I'm claiming a lot of credit over the music. You started with Alestes, I think. So tell us about writing a... Well, first of all, what does that mean when you're writing a bed for a character?
Well, it's perhaps unfair to say I was writing the bed specifically. The way that I do these things now, knowing that everything's going to be edited later, is basically designed to extract just loads of assets, to use the library term, just tons and tons of little files that can be used for different situations. And they're all taken out from these suites that I do. And in this case, it ended up being that the suites represented specific characters of, you know, most importance in the narrative, and that offered the biggest tonal range. And so how we started was, yes, with Alestes, but making sure that that suite covers as many tonal beats as possible. Essentially, within that suite, there's just different arrangements of the theme. And from that, I can then take out what we call music beds, which are essentially flavors, pads, textures, things that you associate with a character that can be placed underneath dialogue, underneath, you know, just anything to give you a musical kind of tonal anchor, if that's too pretentious, to latch onto while you're, you know, following the story, really. And the music bed is the kind of simplest form of the music can take. So it's not theme driven, it's not, you know, grabbing you by the collar musically and dragging you through. There's no need for that. That's what the dialogue's doing. It's just giving you a feeling. And so it can be very simple textural stuff, but it's got the sound qualities of that character.
I've been finding it really interesting listening to, because you've uploaded it to Spotify now.
Finally.
So I do just listen to it. I have been finding it really interesting, because I didn't hear any of the music until it was in the episodes, really. And so listening to the songs and hearing them individually and by character. So there are five tracks, the main theme, Alestes and Siva, and then Gammon. And it has been really interesting like listening to the episodes now after I've heard the suites and being like, oh, like that's where that's pulled from, and it's really thematic. And I'm like, if I didn't write the episodes, I would write an essay about how the sound editors have used themes to like hint at certain things. You can really find a lot of like interesting, not spoilers, foreshadowing, yeah, in the episodes just by listening to the character suites.
I mean, that's great. I can't take credit. The editors, you know, I kind of relinquish responsibility. I basically give them endless folders and subfolders of what this music is for them to use, and they take it away in this case, and you know, that's great. I'm glad that that's going well, but that's kind of what we discussed early on, is making sure that there was enough to do that, because you know, in an ideal world, you know, I'd be able to score the whole thing, but yeah. if you actually tally up the minutes, I mean, it's many films worth, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just budgetary and practical concerns. You just can't do it. So it's doing it in a way that's intelligent and hopefully sensitive to what's going to be needed. But, yeah, absolutely. It's all, you know, what you hear on, finally now, is on Spotify. I'm rubbish with uploading music. Listeners to other podcasts know. But, yeah, it is there. And, you know, you can hear everything in there. I don't think I've written anything new as a sort of a music bed or a sting. I've not created anything new. It's all just extracted from those arrangements. It gives it a bit more coherence that way, and a bit more focus to represent those characters.
It's also a great way of thinking about character. From my sort of director perspective, it was a really useful tool early on for thinking about character, being asked this question, yeah, what is the tonal palette of each of these characters? And obviously, again, with unlimited time and budget, I think we would have gone on to do it for every single character in the show. But again, we had to prioritize, and those are the four characters, Alessi, Zan, Siva and Gammon, that we sort of ended up focusing on for different reasons. With Alestes, I remember the conversation where we were talking about her darkness and her drive, but also that there's something very childlike in the core of her, and that her fundamental desires really stem from childhood. So how could we bring that little kind of bit of, oh, I suppose it's hope, but I think it's love, basically. I think, you know, how could we bring that little bit of love kind of into the foreground of her character occasionally? Anna's kind of partly a plot-motivated decision to focus on her, because, like you said, Nemo, she sort of appears in the background of scenes, and she often sort of heralds that something big is about to go down. She tends to pop up at moments of high drama. Siva's our way into the world, and he's who we kind of start with, so we focus on him. And obviously you have to have a set of villain music, so yeah. It kind of had to be Gammon, because he obviously has to represent, as well as being a threat in and of himself, he has to represent all of the existential threats to this crew. But yeah, and I kind of, my sort of justification to myself of, you know, why we didn't then get to go on and do Baker and Noor and Inez is kind of like, well, they're all wrapped up within the main theme. They're all, you know, they exist as a unit, as a crew, as well as individually, and they're all present in that theme, I think. It's what I'm going to tell myself anyway.
Yeah, and I think season one as well, like, it is about unwrapping who Siva and Alestes are specifically, and Gammon and Anne, and the others have to fall into them a little bit. Like, that's kind of the plot of season one, is how can Alessi's control this group of people? So yeah, I think it's the right choice.
The choices you've made as well naturally kind of offered musical variation as well. It naturally is colourful musically because they're such varied characters. And so I think that's always a bonus when you're bringing that music, you know, in the edit, to have so much to play with and so much that you can immediately identify to as different from another. Like Gammon, for instance, it's clearly more Western influenced music than the rest, so that's a nice contrast to everything else. And then, you know, I mean, going back to Alestes is definitely my favorite of the suites, because it's just so much fun to write. But that, yeah, just going back to what you said, Raph, about the tonal range for Alestes, that was really interesting, because there has to be that sense of danger, that sense of adventure, integrating heritage as well, like both sort of Chinese and African. That was really cool musically to try and get that together. And then there has to be the sensitivity, the musical explanation for, you know, why she's like that, you know?
Yeah.
And there was scope. I think you actually requested more as well. The scope for more emotional arrangement, and yeah, and that actually turned out to be one of my favourite bits of Wan playing the Erhu. Is he just did this amazing like interpretation of this melody? Is it, you can hear it at the end of the suite on whatever you listen to it on. Yeah, it's just got very simple orchestral strings under it, but then this Erhu performance above it, it's incredible.
Well, you're always thinking very much, but this is a little bit like, oh, how the sausage gets made. So, you know, stop listening now if you don't want to think about these characters being, like, constructed by people who want to make you cry. But you are always thinking ahead, kind of going, all right, well, where is the emotional heartbeat of the show? Where are the moments that kind of sock you in the gut? Where are they going to reside? And obviously so many of those are about Alestes sort of searching for this relationship with her parents. So yeah, I think that's why I made that request for there, you know, to give us more that where from which we could create these moments of these kind of, and again, I sort of don't mean this literally, but these sort of minor key moments for Alestes, because I think she is a character who exists in major key and kind of bombastic, sort of larger than lifeness so much of the time. So the ability to see her energy drop, which also is reflected in the fact that she, you know, has these moments of physical kind of exhaustion and physical vulnerability. You see, everything's connected. It's all connected, as above, so below.
Yeah, bittersweet, you know, music is always, I think, the most fun stuff to write. It's the most complex emotionally, and, you know, it's always nice to do those kinds of arrangements. So, yeah, that was probably my favourite of the suites to do. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, also, I that's the one I'm happiest with, I think, because it should be weird to hear, like, a guzheng, this Chinese zither that everyone recognizes from every Chinese film, that it's got like Hero, you know, it's full of that stuff. You know, mixing that with sort of African tuned percussion and drums, and they should feel weird, but I hope that it's kind of made coherent and makes sense, because that is Alestes' character, so like, yeah. I really wanted that to work. Yeah, so happy with that one.
I mean, I personally love it a lot, and like every time I listen to it, I get very happy.
Oh, so. I'm glad.
Yes, I think we're heading towards wrapping up, but before we go, Nima, I wanted to ask you about, there's a piece of music that in the end didn't make it into the show. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, my ongoing desire to make Trice Forgotten into a musical. Where if we had all the budget in the world and all the money, every episode would have like 5 songs into it, because I love writing musicals. But in episode 5, Trawl, the characters, apart from Alestes, were going to sing a shanty to show that they're working together now, or they're coming together. And I actually wasn't a big part in production, so I don't really know much of like how you, Rath, and Sam worked with something like the shanty. How were you planning on going towards it? So basically, I had written some lyrics into the script and then was like, and now it's your problem.
Well, I think that's sort of partly what it was because it's all your fault, Nemo, because you don't know the lyrics. Because it wasn't a pre-existing sea shanty, which, as I am sure many listeners know, but that, you know, one of the purposes of those is to create a rhythm while a crew is kind of hauling on the ropes, which is what our crew is doing in that episode. So it's a very natural place to have a sea shanty. But yeah, Nemo had written one into the script, and then it essentially became a process of we sort of, if we're not going to do this beautifully, then we're not going to do it at all, and we'll save that, we'll shelve it for further down the line. So it was, I think we were kind of trying to find someone with a sort of specialism in that kind of folk music, sort of sea shanty, to kind of decompose tune it. But then we also couldn't, it was after we'd finished recording, so we couldn't, it was also sort of a scheduling thing as well, we couldn't get the cast back together to record it. And it actually ended up having an effect on the storytelling of the episode, and I think in a positive way, because what it meant was we sort of saved that beat of, oh, the crew is working perfectly in unison now. So if you go back and you listen to that episode, even when they're kind of going haul, haul, you know, I think Baker kind of giving the rhythm, they're not quite in time with each other. So actually there's a little thing like, there's still, you know, it's episode 5 of the show, they're still, they're not quite functioning in the sort of perfect harmony yet as a crew. Like they're still just about getting by. So I think kind of narratively it ended up being a good decision to save that as well.
Yeah, definitely forced the content to come before my desire to just put the sea shanty in, because I was like, it's a, you know, a nautical epic, it has to have sea shanty in it, they all have to come together and sing the song. But you are right, when I was like listening to the episode, I was like, yes, they should not be together yet, and when they do come together in the future, it will be so much more earned, because everyone will know that it's like, yes, they are working together. That is group cohesion.
Yeah. And this is also because they're sharing their stories while they're doing that haul as well. So we have Baker tells us the Glooskap story, and Noor talks about Yemen. So they're just starting to open up to each other. And I think also if you then had the shanty on top of that, it's almost too many set pieces in a way. So there's also something about the rhythm of the whole episode as well. But I mean, again, this is, I feel like I've spent 5 minutes sort of justifying why we couldn't do something, but I do genuinely think it was, it's a beautiful possibility. It's not a kill your babies, it's a save your babies for the future. And it's something that we have to look forward to.
Yeah, I saved it in a separate document, and I'm like, ha ha ha. Yeah, so future seasons in my head are built around the fact that, sorry Sam, the rest of the show, if we get the ability to make more of this show, is all a musical. Season 2, season 3, sung through in its entirety.
Yeah, so get cracking on that, Sam. We await the demos in our inboxes.
Really good.
This is a good time to introduce our Kickstarter for Christ Forgotten the Musical.
Live on stage, West End, exclusive.
All performed by Nemo.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, everyone would be really excited to hear me sing. Definitely.
With that image of Nemo performing their solo Thrice Forgotten, rapidly multi-rolling through the entire cast. That is a very lovely place for you to close. Before we do, Sam, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. Where can we find you?
Well, absolute pleasure, Raph. You can hear some of my music on Spotify, very slowly uploading things. I have a website, but that's only okay. And IMDb, you can see what I've worked on. I'm one of very many Sam Jones composers, so good luck finding me. But yes, continuing to work on Rustic Bell stuff, so you can see me around for sure.
And Nemo, where can we find you?
As ever, I am on Twitter and Tumblr at Zeus-Japonicus, or you can just type my name in, or if you're in the Thrice Forgotten tag, I'm also there.
And as ever, I am on at Raffaella Marcus on Twitter. Thank you so much, Sam, and thank you, Nemo. So until next time, it is goodbye from me, Raff, and goodbye from Sam and Nemo.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thrice Forgotten is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International License. The series is created by Nemo Martin and directed by Raffaella Marcus, and was edited by Laurie Ann Davis and Catherine Ranella. Thrice Forgotten is produced by Ian Gears, Laurie Ann Davis, and production manager Natasha Johnston, with executive producers Alexander J. Newell and April Sumner. To subscribe, view associated materials, or join our Patreon, visit rustyquill.com. Rate and review us online. Tweet us at TheRustyQuill. Visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Thanks for listening.